Jesus warns me that if I cause a child to stumble, it would be better for me if a millstone were hung round my neck and I were drowned in the depths of the sea. To cause a child to stumble is simply to place some obstacle in the child's path, making it difficult or impossible for him or her to come to Jesus. If we want to flourish, if we want children to flourish in the Christian family, they need a true picture of Jesus, although even our best attempt at one is bound to be a poor likeness. As an adult, I may find my image of Jesus compelling, but if the picture that pleases me repels the child or does not make sense to the child, it is a false image. It follows that I must wrestle with the angel of childhood until that angel tells me the secret of how children perceive. Perhaps then the image of Jesus or of God I offer them may not be such a grotesque caricature. Childhood, however, is a mysterious realm which does not yield its secrets lightly. Henry Vaughan reminds us of the sheer inaccessibility of childhood. I cannot reach it, and my striving eye dazzles at it as at eternity. We ask what it means to be a child. Where can we go for answers to that question? Now, in this paper, I take a route that, so far as I know, has not often been taken. Over the last year or two, under the kindly oversight of Jerome Berriman, the creator of Godly Play, who has been mentioned already once or twice by Keith, under Jerome's oversight, I have been studying published autobiographies of childhood, memoirs like Frank Kendon's The Small Years, and these I'm finding are proving a rich resource. I am looking to these memoirs for light. Light on what it is about children that should inform our Christian discipleship and guide our nurture of children in the church. I search these texts for what they tell us in one word instead of dozens more about the spirituality of the child. Now, much has been said by Keith already about the problems of that term, spirituality. Of course, escapes definition, as do such concepts as goodness or love. But what cannot be defined can sometimes be recognized and described. For years, I've worked with a broad brush description of spirituality, a description, not a definition, that has served tolerably well. Our spirituality, I suggest, is our moral awareness of the other and the beyond. Such awareness is not illusory. It is an innate dimension of our human nature. It is how we are. Now, this isn't the place to defend that premise. That has been well done elsewhere, notably by David Hay in his study, The Biology of the Human Spirit, entitled Something There. The spiritual is an aspect of our nature, there from the start. Extensive empirical research among young children has shown this to be so. And I refer yet again to Rebecca Nye's The Spirit of the Child. The memories shared with us by the authors of our memoirs, these autobiographies of childhood, I suggest, are further testimony to this truth. That from our earliest days, the spiritual is an inalienable dimension of our humanity. So, I turn to memoirs of childhood. Mischievously, I turn first to one that you may feel is not a memoir at all, not least because it is only half a sentence long, and you may tell me because it has nothing to do with childhood. I was alive once. I hope that we all recognise those wistful words. One or two nods, three or four nods, one or two not sures. I was alive once. St. Paul is writing to God's beloved in Rome, and he makes this remark in chapter 7, verse 9 of his letter to them. Of course, Paul has a lot more to say. Paul writes, I was alive once apart from the law, but when the commandment came, sin revived and I died. And the complicated argument goes on much longer. But I'll stay with those first few words, and I'll make a series of assertions about them, not because I wish my argument to be undistracted by facts, but because time is short. I was alive once apart from the law, says Paul. There's our mini memoir. When, nearly 50 years ago now, I first slowed down long enough to look at this text closely, certain features about it struck me. I noticed that Paul is using the first person singular. When people use the first person singular, they are usually talking about themselves. If I say to you, I was once a vegetarian, I may mean Adam was a vegetarian, but that wouldn't be how you would understand me if you were asking me round for supper and asking whether I had any dietary requirements. So I concluded that Paul's I should have its natural sense. He is here speaking for himself and about himself. He is saying, I, Paul, and the pronoun ego is there in the Greek. I, Paul, was alive once apart from the law. And then I worried over this little phrase, apart from the law, or simply apart from law, for there is no definite article in the Greek, choris nomo, it reads. Was there ever a time in his life at which Paul, the zealous Jew, could have said that he was not subject to the law? Yes, there was. For in Jewish thought, before a child attains moral awareness, he cannot be held to be a transgressor of God's law. So I concluded that Paul's once referred to his childhood. And what does Paul claim about his childhood? He claims that he was alive. I asked myself all those years ago what Paul means by that, by insisting that as a child he was alive. It seemed to me then, as it seems to me now, that he means much more than biological life. He means life in relation to God, being spiritually alive. I could see no reason to suppose that Paul has defaulted here to a lesser sense of what it means to be alive than the idea of life that holds elsewhere in the letter to the Romans. So I came to these three audacious conclusions about what Paul is saying. I dared to suggest, and here are my assertions, first, that Paul is talking about himself. Secondly, that he is talking about his own childhood. And thirdly, that he is claiming that as a child he was, as he puts it earlier in Romans, alive to God in Christ Jesus. In other words, we must give to Paul's statement, I was alive, the great and glorious weight that the vocabulary of life carries throughout the letter to the Romans, and indeed throughout the rest of his epistles. And that is where I still stand on this text. And at this point, our chairman may be wondering whether to summon security and have me escorted from the hall. When these words first lodged under my skin all those years ago, I trawled through lots of commentaries on Romans, and I noticed something rather remarkable. I noticed that I could herd the commentators into two distinct groups. In the first group were the commentators who recognized that in Romans 7:9, Paul is referring to his childhood. But these commentators in this first group refused to accept that Paul's "I was alive" could possibly mean alive to God. So they interpret Paul as meaning "I thought I was alive," or "I was under the illusion I was alive." Or they have Paul merely saying, "I was once, apart from the law." In the other group were the commentators who recognized that Paul's "I was alive" must carry the same theological weight that it bears elsewhere where Paul uses such language. But these commentators in our second group are precisely those who dismiss any idea that Paul is referring to his childhood. "Ganz unmöglich," thunders the great German theologian Werner Kümmel. "Ganz ausgeschlossen," completely impossible, completely inadmissible. When all those years ago I looked at what these learned scholars had said about the Pauline text, it eventually dawned on me what they had in common. What united the two schools of thought, those on the one hand who give Paul's "I was alive" its full force, but who deny that Paul is referring to his childhood, and those on the other hand who recognize the allusion to childhood but drain Paul's "I was alive" of any theological significance, what these two bodies of opinion have in common was the unchallenged, unexamined, axiomatic premise that only grown-ups can be truly Christians. Sadly, that premise has gone unchallenged in Christian theology, at least in the West, very different story in the East, down to modern times. So, until quite recently, mainstream evangelicalism, with its insistence on conversion, left children in a spiritual no-man's land, a kind of limbo in which they were old enough to go to hell but too young to go to heaven. I used to get into a lot of trouble for calling this beach mission theology, a theology that was equivocal about the status of the very ones about whom Jesus makes himself absolutely plain. Thank God the Christian mind has moved on these matters. We have begun at least to register Jesus' estimate of children, unprecedented and unparalleled in antiquity. His affirmation that of such is the kingdom of God. I simply propose that in recalling his childhood, Paul has allowed the mind of Christ to shape his own, that he has made Christ's understanding of childhood his. More recently, with this talk in mind, I returned to Romans 7:9 and referred to more up-to-date commentaries. It was, I have to report, a thoroughly depressing experience. Most of the comment was no more than a recycling of what had been said about this text countless times before. Only one commentator I came across allowed the possibility that Paul is looking back on his childhood, but for this commentator, Paul's "I was alive" carries no weight. Paul might simply have said, "I was." Why do these commentators refuse to recognize the possibility that at Romans 7:9, Paul is referring to his childhood? I suggest that it is simply because biblical commentaries are written in child-free zones. The child of which our text speaks is not noticed because children are rarely noticed by clever grown-ups who write commentaries. Jesus sets a child in the midst of his disciples. Having a child in the midst makes a world of difference, not only to how you understand children, but to how you understand much else besides, including contentious Greek texts. And that is what I hear the advocates of the child theology movement telling me. Alas, there is no sign of a child in the midst of those who write fat commentaries on Romans. I was alive once, says Paul. We hear many writers of more recent memoirs of childhood saying much the same. And now, somewhat abruptly, I turn to these. Memoirs of childhood, published autobiographies of childhood, most of them a little bit longer than those 4 or 5 words of St. Paul. Several themes emerge. I mention 7 fleetingly and an 8th marginally less fleetingly. First, there is the primacy of the present moment. The poet Kathleen Rayner tells us that as a child, she lived in a here and now that had no beginning and no end. Jean-Pierre de Cussot wrote famously about the sacrament of the present moment. The children we meet in our memoirs receive that sacrament. They live in that moment. Secondly, children reach out in their imagination to other worlds and to unseen friends. They press beyond the boundaries that grown-ups rarely cross. Many children, it seems, already experience that sense of exile that many Christians recognize, our awareness that ultimately we are far from home. It came as no surprise to me to read about the unseen friends our writers made when they were children. We've all known children like that, and maybe we can recall from our own childhoods that we had a friend who was our companion that nobody else could see. But I was fascinated to find some of these writers, looking back on their childhood, claiming that as children they had a vivid sense of the friendship of Jesus, a sense of his presence and companionship. And they enjoyed this sense quite independently of any religious teaching they'd received. That was the experience, for example, of the poets Richard Church in his lovely memoir Over the Bridge, or of the poet James Kirkup, who wrote 2 memoirs of his childhood, The Only Child and Sorrows, Passions and Alarms. That's the second theme. A third theme emerging from our recalled childhoods is spiritual distress. Spiritual distress is a term that's now has some currency, and it's received that currency from its use in the literature of the nursing community. Lord, give to men who are old and tougher the things that little children suffer. Children hurt. There is the physical and material suffering of children. God knows, appalling enough. But the suffering I register from my reading is intense inward pain, spiritual distress. The primal affliction is fear. Fear of what awaits, of who awaits, in the darkness, at the head of the stairs. Rings bells, all of us, I'm sure. But there is a deeper darkness children experience, so our memoirs testify. It seems that some children, as well as some saints, experience the dark night of the soul. Forgive me that I'm just touching so absurdly briefly on these themes one by one. Fourthly, many recollections of childhood reflect the child's delight in nature and her sense of kinship with living things. Ours is an urbanized age. Half the world's children live in cities. Our own children no longer go out of doors to play as they used to. I'd love to hear more from, I think, the representative of Curbs who are with us today. And the consequence is acute spiritual malnourishment. The words of Jesus suddenly take on a new urgency. For your very salvation's sake, consider the lilies of the field.
Fifth,
timeless moments. Children experience what T.S. Eliot called the unattended moment, the moment in and out of time. Wordsworth called these occasions of heightened awareness spots of time. Abraham Maslow calls them peak experiences. Some of these experiences, our writers recall, sound like the transports of the saint, the adult saint, that is, who has spent a lifetime climbing the ladder of perfection, listening to those taken out of time and place in childhood. We will want to redraw some of our boundary lines within which we have limited the spiritual potential of the child. A sixth theme in these memoirs is the troubled relationship of spirituality and religion. We ask why it is that for some children, religion nourishes their spiritual life, while for others, religion throttles it. The child Percy Lubbock, in his memoir Earlham, which I happen to think is the loveliest of all these memoirs of childhood, the child Percy Lubbock recalls how at evensong in his parish church at the end of a beautiful summer's day, he experienced a mystical awareness beyond words. By contrast, the Belfast storyteller Forrest Reid, who had an equally acute sense of the transcendent, rages against religion. "I hated Sunday," he writes. "I hated Bible stories. I hated everybody mentioned in both the Old and New Testaments, except perhaps the impenitent thief, Eve Snake, and a few similar characters." Why did Lubbock love going to church, but Reid loathe it? Perhaps it is because Percy Lubbock's vicar was his beloved grandfather, but Forrest Reid had to suffer the ministry of the furtive she-evangelist, Miss Crouch. I begin to understand from these recalled childhoods, and here's a seventh theme, something of the importance of language and music for the flourishing of our spirituality. Opinions differ as to whether or not children's spirituality needs a received religious tradition in which to flourish, but there is little disagreement that spirituality requires language. The spirit answers to words and to music. Our writers tell us how stories and songs spoke to them as children. So too, at least to some children, did the language of the Bible and liturgy, whether or not those children grew up later to be religious believers. The evidence of our memoirs is that the child's spirit is fed by language. We must choose our words carefully, with an ear to how they sound. For if sounds displease, sense can go begging. If sounds displease, sense can go begging. But what struck me most in reflecting on these memoirs, and now I'm slowing down for my eighth and last lap, is this. The adult notion that the spiritual is somehow elevated above the sensory is a mischievous one. The poet James Kirkup had remarkable powers of recall. He remembered even his infancy in sharp detail. He recalls that his early childhood was a world full of wonders, though the things he found wonderful would scarcely have seemed so to adult eyes. He recalls such marvels as the boot scraper by the front door of the family home and the treasures hidden behind it, a matchstick, a piece of gravel, a pink tram ticket, a button. The testimony of our memoirs is that there is a spiritual dimension to those early sensory perceptions. Adults distinguish between the sensory, the sensual too, and the spiritual. It is a false distinction leading, for example, to catastrophic misreadings of the biblical Song of Songs, and children do not make it. Western thought has been dominated by the dualism that opposes the physical and the spiritual with calamitous consequences. For the child, body and soul are one. The psychotherapist Ella Sofita Fenn was born and brought up in Russia in the early years of the 20th century. Later, she became a British subject. As a little girl, she learnt to dance. Dancing for her was a single, rapturous experience of both body and spirit. This was ecstasy, she writes, to be compared only with the dreams of flying. I was discovering how a state of the body could become a means of attaining the exaltation of the spirit. And if we've seen any of us, many of us have, I'm sure, if we've seen Billy Elliot, we'll know what she means. There is a chorus that used to be taught to children in evangelical churches, Bible classes and Sunday schools. I learnt it in my Crusader class. Turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full in his wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. That chorus asks the impossible of the child, to separate the spiritual and the sensory. Mystics will claim that there are levels of spiritual experience that rise above the material. Maybe. But it's not mandatory for us to become mystics, at least not just yet. We are required to become children. If I turn and become as a child, the things of earth will not grow strangely dim. On the contrary, they will become strangely bright. Christian faith and worship are grounded in the principle that the sensory can be charged with the spiritual. This we know by what douses us at our baptism and by what we taste at Holy Communion, at the Eucharist. Material things can be much more than they materially are. The Chilean poet Pablo Neruda, though not a Christian believer, filled his several houses with things. Old bottles, hammers, seashells, compasses, and all manner of other objects. And my wife and I were able to visit a number of his houses earlier this year. Neruda did this because he remained at heart a child for whom nothing was merely ordinary. Christians must learn to wonder before they can reign or rest. The maxim from a papyrus fragment found on an ancient rubbish dump in Egypt is the truth our memoirs are telling us. Christians must learn to wonder before they can reign or rest. In some Christian churches, possibly this one, I don't know, much is made of the baptism of the Spirit. Nothing less is required of us, I suggest, in becoming a child than a baptism of the senses. And I think I'll pause there, Robert. I have no idea where we are time-wise, but I hope I've not overrun too much.
Okay.